This is Redefine Ed, and I'm Travis Pillow. Recently, I spoke with Jim Blue, who served as president for the National Students First organization, and following a merger with the 50 Can Network, will be focusing his efforts on California.
Hello, and welcome to Redefine, your home for news about parental school choice and education reform.
This month, it was announced that probably two of the biggest state-level advocacy networks in the country, that being 50 Can and Students First, are going to be merging together in a new organization. Since you've been involved with Student First for quite some time, what do you think the vision of the new organization is going to be for public education, and what do you think it's trying to accomplish? How will you know that it's working?
So that really hasn't changed for either organization in the merger. Both have been interested in improving education policy across the country. And there have been two pillars of activity that are consistent to both organizations. One is to increase the number of high-quality choices available to students, particularly in low-income areas, where, regrettably, the number of high-quality options in low-income communities is rather small, but it's much larger than it used to be. So we've made a lot of progress over the last 20 years, but we have a long way to go. Secondly, both organizations believe that the people in those institutions should be accountable to students' performance. That is, of course, in sharp contrast to being accountable for following the rules and inputs that most of the school districts in this country focus on. It's actually holding people accountable for how well students do in their learning.
So with those two pillars, it seems like there's a considerable variation in the states where y'all are active as far as what's in place now and what might be achievable. So how does the advocacy vary state by state? And then when you've got this sort of diverse state by state landscape, what do you gain by having a larger national network?
So the key point in your question is that each state is different, each political context is different, the children are different, and as a result, each state requires a different strategy. However, there are some fundamentals that are the same, and it's probably worth taking a moment to say what hasn't changed very much in the last 20 years in education in our country. So first of all, there's student learning. And what we see is that we have about 30% of our children not on track to be educated well enough to go to college or to advance to a career. And that number is so shocking that sometimes people don't want to confront it. It translates into somewhere between 16 million and 19 million children who are going to be not leading very productive lives, and some would say would be a burden on society. Now, the reason that those children are not getting educated is complicated, but the two things we know will be a systemic solution to that are creating high-quality options and creating a meritocracy by holding people accountable for student learning. If you're in advocacy, you need to recognize that there is a group out there who has the mere opposite point of view on choice and accountability. If you're trying to build up a teacher union, you don't want choice because choice means you leave the schools that you control. You also don't want accountability for student performance because that implies that some teachers are better than others, something that I think is common sense for most folks. But if you stop treating teachers as widgets, then you can no longer use seniority as your key factor. You will have to start using the performance of teachers to make labor decisions. So because none of that has really changed, I think we need the full complement of advocacy efforts in every state. But the mix of how you use those will be different. So for example, litigation strategies where we resort to the courts to change some of the laws are more preeminent in states where there's not a legislative solution that's very obvious. So you'll see in places like New York and in California, where the state legislatures are pretty much pinned down against any change that would attack those two pillars of choice and accountability, you see people resorting to the court. The litigation efforts are almost always sort of the tool of last resort, and the reason for that is that it's a very high-risk strategy. So the Vergara case in California is a good illustration of this. Vergara did win at the first level, but when it went to the appellate court overturned it, which means now we're going to appeal up to the state Supreme Court. But when you go through that kind of process, it's very much, you know, winner take all, and so we don't know what's going to happen to a very strong challenge to the 10-year dismissal laws that are sort of demonstrably hurting children right now in California. So that's just one tactic that might be used. How you take an approach with legislative effort varies state by state, depending on what kind of champions you have, what the composition is of the legislature, both by party and by ideology. Absolutely, we have to have different approaches for each state.
So when I look across the national landscape or the, you know, the national headlines on education, there's, I think, a couple of things that seem to be, that seem to sort of stick out as far as where we stand. The first of those is that we're in the spring, it's testing season, and once again, opt-out and anti-testing crowds, we're hearing a lot about them. It's not really clear to me whether more parents are actually participating, but I think what we're seeing this year is that the teachers' union involvement is getting even more explicit.
First of all, it should be no surprise to anyone that the teacher unions understand that you need to have evaluation of students to tie to the performance of teachers. So they really have only two strategies. One is to make sure there are no tests, or to make sure that the tests are only used for helping teachers and not holding them accountable. And so that is, it's not surprising. What is surprising about it is that they've become more and more explicit about how they don't want students tested or having the students' test scores tied to teacher decisions, labor decisions. So I do think that over time the opt-out movement fizzles because policymakers, parents, taxpayers want to see if what we are doing in our schools is having an impact on student learning. There's also something healthy about this. It forces policymakers to consider a more nuanced way of measuring the performance of children. And it can't be all about achievement tests. No one in the education reform movement ever thought it should be all about achievement tests, but they thought that we do need some objective measures. And we recognize those measures will get better and better over time. So there is something healthy about the opt-out movement is that it forces all of us to think more deeply about how we actually evaluate students and tie that to the performance of teachers.
Second of all, the new federal education accountability law devolved a lot of the authority over especially accountability and school improvement back to the states.
So let's not forget that the states have always been the critical lever for policy change in education reform. And over the last 10 years since NCLB, there, you know, if you look at this from a larger perspective, what happened is that the federal government became so frustrated with how states were not living up to their responsibilities that they became more involved in education policy, demanding that children be graded and that those that the performance of students be transparent, and then, you know, took some other steps about raising standards, encouraging teacher evaluation, several things that were things that the states actually should have been doing themselves for, you know, the last couple of decades. And many states were. This is something else we forget. Like, when NCLB came into being, several states had already implemented a lot of what was in there. Over time, the states said, please, we want that back, as did the labor interests. They wanted it back at the state level, too, because they have more political power, typically, in those states. So to me, as we look back on NCLB, it will be a short blimp of time where the federal government said, enough already, we have to start really focusing on a problem that is hurting the entire nation. That it's now, I think the word you used was devolved back to the states, is more the natural course of how we've run education policy in this country from the beginning. It's not a big shift. I think we'll look at NCLB as the aberration over time. So with states being more important than ever, the people who are working in states on policy, 50CAN, Students First, and many, many other groups across the country, notably the charter school associations and such. The ball is very clearly back in their court, but I'd argue it really never was out of their court. It's a thing that does put more pressure on states to live up to what the country needs, and if they fail, I imagine the federal government will again intrude into state public policy making.
And then number three, we're seeing a lot of school choice and policies. We're seeing private school choice, you know, every year rack up a series of legislative victories. Charter schools are breaking down the walls in Washington State, in Alabama. They're expanding in Oklahoma and Mississippi. They're sort of breaking down the walls in the last remaining holdout states.
So one perspective is that we keep clawing away and we continue to win opportunities for children to attend the schools of their choice. And we create more and more quality options through both the charter laws and through these private scholarship programs. I would argue your view embedded in your question was much more optimistic than the reality on the ground. I'd say creating high-quality alternatives to the traditional system is a very fragile effort that continues to be under attack every day from the teacher unions and their allies. And yes, it's true. And many of those charter schools are outperforming their local school districts. Most of them are. But the reality of running a charter school is that you still feel every day that somebody's trying to snuff out your school. And anybody who's been involved in the scholarship programs will tell you the same thing. You're in Florida. You know about the attacks that's happening through the courts there. That's the mirror image of what's happening for reformers. Like, the teacher unions have taken to the courts to try and stop that program. All that suggests is that we need to focus our advocacy efforts at the state level to protect those programs and hopefully continue to grow and reach into more states over time.
I guess to your point about school choice, it looks like I believe, if I'm reading this correctly, that all of the 50 CAN states and all of the Students First states all now allow charter schools in their laws. And so you mentioned the fact that charter people who run those schools are still feeling like they're constantly under attack. But what does, in a state that already has charters, what does the school choice agenda tend to look like?
So this goes to the question of what is the best way to encourage the creation of high-quality options in a state. And over the last decade, we've seen that the key vehicle for that has been public charter schools. And the reason is twofold. One is that the opposition to private school scholarship is from the teachers' unions is much more vehement than what it would be for charter schools. Now, they don't like either, but at least with charter schools, they have an opportunity to organize and create new members through the public charter school. As you know, many charter schools are unionized already. And that opportunity really only exists in very few private school settings, mostly because of economies of scale. It's not worthwhile to organize private schools. So the teacher union strategy, writ large, has been to control the Democratic Party. So they do very little with the Republican Party across the country, and they have focused their efforts on making sure they control the Democratic Party. And because of that, it was always the vehemence against scholarships allowed, it was easier for Democrats to say, oh, I believe in choice, particularly public school choice and particularly charter schools, where it's very hard to be a Democrat, given their influence in the party, to say, I believe that children should be given scholarships and allowed to go to private school. So there's the sort of the political dynamics that it was always easier to get charters. There's something else that happened, which is that charter schools were getting, you know, not 100% of the money that traditional schools were, but, you know, above 70%. And the scholarship programs were typically being designed to be about 50% of what traditional schools were. And because of that, it had a supply impact. So you did not have private schools being created to meet the supply for the scholarship programs. Typically what was happening is we were using the excess capacity in private schools and no growth beyond that. On the charter school side, the dollars were enough that we could actually create more supply and more create more schools. So until that flaw in the way the scholarship programs have been created, I don't see them generating new supply. There's one final point. The private school sector did not come alongside the reformers who were trying to create these scholarship programs. And that took many forms, but often it took the form of, we actually don't want the children you're giving scholarships to, because the programs were designed in a way that we targeted the lowest income families. But when you had mission-driven people who wanted to serve those children, then we were under-resourcing them with the scholarship programs. So the schools did not turn out to be as highly effective as the charter schools. And that has left a taint on the scholarship movement in several places around the country. And until that issue of quality gets addressed, I see that it'll be even harder for us to continue growing the scholarship program. Where we've done it right, I'd point to Louisiana, Indiana, Florida. We are seeing just the opposite. We're seeing high-quality schools being created. We're seeing students flowing there. But it will take those programs growing to a more substantial level to convince other states that it's a policy they should adopt.
Gotcha. Do you see that? Do you see scholarships being in the mix for the new Students First 50K? And it kind of feels like charter schools are really the main issue nationally that gets a lot more attention.
I would say that both organizations believe in private school choice, meaning that children should have the opportunity to go to high quality private schools through scholarship programs. But that there are two issues there. One is sort of that's a philosophical belief. We think that children should be given those opportunities. Then there's the political reality of what we can accomplish in each of our states. Mm-hmm. And in some states, private school choice is a non-starter. And I would point to California,
right,
where not only is the teachers union here more powerful than in most other states, but they've had a couple of failed attempts to enact scholarship programs through the ballot measure process. And that is, of course, that has led to some renowned losses for the movement. They were probably ill-advised efforts, but you have to appreciate the frustration of the people who ran those programs. They couldn't believe that children were doing so poorly in our state. They were trying to give those kids an option to go to private schools that were performing well for low-income children. So their motivations were all the right ones, and they were frustrated because nothing could get through the legislature that even reeks of private school choice in California. It can't even get into committee. So that's why they went to a ballot measure process, but it's probably hurt the movement here to allow children scholarships for another generation. So we wouldn't even talk about that in California. But in places like Tennessee, where we've been active, private school choice is definitely on the agenda. But this is actually, we've had a very professional program there now for 2 years or two cycles, and yet the bill keeps dying in the very last days of the effort because the political dynamics are they just, if charter schools are fine, but, you know, taking that extra step to say children should be allowed to go to private and religious schools on a scholarship just has failed by one or two votes each time.
it kind of seems like there's a growing divide between groups of states. You've said that you personally are going to be focused on California in the future. Florida, on the other hand, if we look at Florida, there's a lot of work that needs to be done, especially around, you know, ensuring the quality of school choice options. But at the same time, we're pretty far down the line as far as allowing all the different options that exist, having accountability and teacher evaluation programs in place. The work is never done, but it seems like we're pretty far along in that regard. How does that differ from a state like California, and what do you think drives that difference? I mean, is it just the power of the teachers union, or are there other issues in play?
There is something else that's happened, and that is that you have a proof point that California doesn't have. So your program has grown over time, and the elected officials, Republican and Democrat, have seen the results. And if you're a Democrat and you're seeing what's happening in your community because kids are allowed to take scholarship money and attend a private school and get educated, then it takes away some of the boogeyman arguments. It's very difficult for our opposition to say, see how awful it can be, all right, when right in front of a Democratic legislator are families that are benefiting from it. So I do think over time we will see this issue become more bipartisan. Not in California, but in states that have ready access to Florida and they can see what's happening. I would say states that are close to Indiana and see what's happening there will also be influenced. But this is something that will not happen overnight, and it takes getting Democratic legislators to open their minds enough to actually go see what's happening on the ground.